with really very little to do, because although it was very, very, very time-consuming to raise kids, the other parts of housework had become a lot easier to handle.
Right. You know, it's interesting, and we'll get into it in a second, because my mother used to relate it to the Germanic phrase KKK, yeah. Kircher, Kinder, and Kusche. In other words, the church, the children, and the kitchen. And that was what the old world idea of...
That was your world, yeah.
That was what it was expected. You know, the essence of your new book, When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women, is the aspect of this change, you know, in a sense, has everything really changed? And what's the biggest unresolved problem for women in America with all this advancement?
Well, to say that everything has changed is not to say that everything has gotten perfect. Some things have changed.
Well, they'll keep on changing also.
Weird ways, and they'll keep on changing anyway. But the thing that changed was that, I mean, if you go to 1960, it was absolutely legal to say to a woman, you can't have this job because we want a guy for it. Or to say, you can't have a credit card unless your husband co-signs. Or to say, you can't serve on a jury in a lot of southern states because you're a woman, you're needed at home, and on and on. All those legal limitations went away really, really fast within about a 10-year period. And then we sort of digested them at a time when the economy was being transformed in a way that made it need and want more and more women to work. So those were sort of big things that were happening back then, and that created that change. And it's amazing to me that we have gotten to a point now where half the workforce is female, and we have still not dealt with the question of who takes care of the kids when everybody is out at work.
Isn't it spectacular how the term Ms., M-S, became the Mira equivalent to Mr.?
Mm-hmm.
And how about the impact of the term Ms.? I think that is undervalued. What's your thoughts on that?
It was, you know, especially, I must say, if you're a journalist, and, you know, back in the day when everybody had to be called Mrs. or Miss., you found yourself, I mean, if you had some woman who had just been run over by a car or she had just gotten the Medal of Honor, you still had to ask, are you married? You had to find out because you had to figure out whether you were going to call her Miss or Mrs. in the story. And that, I mean, that defining, that total defining of the person by whether or not she's married was a huge thing. And to get past that was just enormous. And
that's,
it took a long time.
And I would say that that's something that's been undervalued. I mean, who is Mrs. Linda Garfunkel or Mrs. Richard Garfunkel? Right?
Yeah, we forgot. You know, I still have my first credit card I ever got, and it's made out to Mrs. Daniel Collins.
Right. Who is that?
That would be the woman who got the credit card.
Right. So it's interesting that if you say Mrs. Linda Garfunkel, she was either divorced or Richard Garfunkel was gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's in other words, she never had an identity until the male in her life. There was a dramatic change,
mm-hmm.
like he wasn't there anymore. You know, I just want to remind our audience that you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming on WVOX.com. I'm Richard Garfunkel, and my guest is Mrs. Gail Collins, author, columnist, reporter, and renowned journalist with the New York Times. Her current book, When Everything Changed, talks about American women's journey over the past 50 years, and it's been a spectacular one. And I want to ask Gail, do you believe that the current struggle between the left wing and the right wing of the political spectrum in this country could eventually lead to a crossroads for women's advancement? Is this going to be a struggle for how women are perceived in the next 20, 30 years?
I don't, on one level, I don't at all, because we talk about this stuff all the time, and will women go back home and become, you know, mothers, full-time moms again on a large scale? The economy will never allow that to happen. We've way past the point where most families can support the kind of middle-class lifestyle we've come to think of sort of as every American's right on one salary. It's just not possible, whether you want to do it or not. Virtually every young girl who goes to school has to think about her life in terms of something in which she'll be a breadwinner, in which she'll earn money and help support her family and take care of herself. So that's, nobody is going to change that. I mean, even if you, we didn't go there because of a theory. We went there because that's the way the world moved on, and we're not going to un-go there. So in that sense, I think no. But I do think if you look back, you know, in the olden days, the Republicans were the party that was more liberal on most social issues, like women's
rights. Well, Prescott Bush was for Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood, all that stuff. And the Democrats were more conservative because their base was sort of in the Catholic working class in the cities. And basically in the late 60s, you see the two parties moving in opposite directions. And there came a point in the early 70s, I think, when they were all kind of in the middle there together when they were crossing. And that's when you got an extraordinary amount of legislation for women. That's when you got the Equal Rights Amendment through Congress. That's when you got a bill actually through Congress, a bipartisan bill providing an entitlement to early childhood education for every family that wanted it. I mean, so there was, it was a sort of a boom time for that kind of legislation. We probably won't see that again
for a while. You know, it's interesting, though. The late Arthur Schlesinger said that America is a different country every generation. Mm-hmm. Now, with that aspect in mind, if the Supreme Court ended the right of choice for women in America, now we know that many states would still probably have choice in the pre-Roe v. Wade day, but you never know coming forward. Do you think the next attack by the right on women's rights could be birth control? And birth control dissemination? Or is that virtually impossible in the way you see it?
I cannot... no, I don't... It's just something... You don't take away from people something that they're all used to having.
Though you had prohibition in 1919.
And it didn't work out well.
That's for sure.
And just get, you just move forward with life. It just doesn't go that way. So far, at least, we haven't seen courts really dying to get rid of abortion as a right. What they seem to be intent on doing is sort of restricting it and making it more and more difficult for women to get abortions, especially in conservative states.
As this subject obviously still festers below the surface every day, it seems, look at the health care bill that's being considered by Congress and this part of it that would restrict federal monies and even crossover monies from private plans that had federal subsidy for abortion. Do you see this as more of a moral or religious effort or a demographic struggle of the right to prevent the Eurocentrists from having access to abortion? What do you think on that?
I got to say, I there are a lot of theories about that. I was raised as a Catholic, and I have, you know, perfect respect for people who believe that this, you know, is murder and that they have to do whatever they can to stop people from doing it. I part ways with the idea that you can dictate to other people what their rights are on this level. But the idea that people will continue to fight against this on religious grounds, I think it's probably inevitable.
But is that the powerful element today? Is that today the impetus behind this resurgence level that's coming out of your evangelical community, not from your Roman Catholic community as much?
I don't know. There are many people. There are some people who think that that's the case. There are some people who think that that's actually been way overestimated. And there are a lot of people who think the Republican Party is changing and getting less interested in social issues.
Yeah. You know, getting away from politics for a moment and back to your own book and the work it entailed, what were you most surprised to learn during your research?
I was actually very surprised. I talked to the women we interviewed, my researchers, excuse me, and I, about 100-odd women who were just regular, normal women, about what their lives were like just to see the way all these changes were working from the ground up and how it looked to them. And I must admit, I was very surprised by the number of people who had Barbie dolls who were having sex of one sort or another. This was way more excitement on the Barbie front than I had any idea about in my own life. And the other thing was that the more serious thing was the fact that Congress had passed this entitlement to quality early child care for anybody who wanted it in the country. It was vetoed by Richard Nixon, and it never came back again. But I had no idea it had ever come back, been there in the first place.
You know, you went to, you had a, your primary education was in religious school, and you went to Marquette, which I believe is a
Jesuit school.
You, and then, of course, you got your doctorate in a secular education. Let's face it, the media and reporting is probably a secular group of people that have ever lived. How about you on a personal basis? Was this a culture shock for you to go from one world, the small world you came from, to the big city?
By the time I got here,
of course, you went to Connecticut.
I mean, when I was in college, it was in the late 60s and early 70s, and both at Marquette and at the University of Massachusetts, where I got my master's degree, there was so much revolution in the air. I mean, there was, you know, this was not a time in which, you know, we were being very sheltered.
Right. I know Northampton, by the way, my friend lived, my friend's wife, Madeline Littlefield, did a lot. Henry Littlefield lived in, was a dean of men at Amherst College, and Madeline did a lot of work at UMass in that period of time, late and 60s and early 70s. So I know the town. They lived on 19 Massasoit Street. They actually lived in Calvin Coolidge's old home.
Well, you can't go worse than that, huh?
Right. And it's funny, when I first visited them in 1966 or so, I met the woman who owned the two-family home and remembered Cool Cal. So that's and yeah, that's a very interesting thing in today's lexicon, the term Cool Cal. You know, as a consequence of the rise of women and minorities, there's been a subsequent decline in the primacy of the white Eurocentric male in America. This has obviously reflected itself in a new and uncharted struggle regarding the battle of the sexes. How does this portend for women in their new roles as breadwinner, activists, policymaker regarding their male coworkers, partners, and significant others? This has caused a strain, I gather.
Well, any change causes a strain, but I think that the defining thing is that the idea of the husband as the guider of the family and the protector of the family, and the wife as the protected person who is sort of the heart or whatever of the family, it has changed into one that's much more about partnership, because
right.
that's just
sharing.
Yeah, I mean, they're working together to support the family. And once you start making money, once you have an economic role, you just naturally have more power in a relationship. That's just the way of the world. So in those senses, and, you know, among younger guys, I don't necessarily see in many places as much of a strain about all this as there was before. You know, I mean, they've grown into this world forever. So many of them are fine with it. But it is true. One of the reasons you're getting so many, such an incredible surge and the number of unwed mothers, is that young women, particularly poor young women, just don't see that there are many young men out there who are good potential husbands.
And they want a child.
Yep.
And, you know, it's interesting, in regards to your own world, you were, of course, a pioneer in terms of becoming the editorial page editor and being a member of the editorial board of the New York Times, sometimes called the Gray Lady. The question was, you must have had men working for you or answering to you, et cetera. How did you feel in that position? And did you sense something with the body language of a younger men, any negativity?
Well, I got to tell you that in the editorial department, we did not have a whole lot of younger men. I mean, this is not writing editorials
tough.
For the New York Times is a really middle-aged occupation.
Yeah, okay.
So there weren't that many young guys. But when I was named, I could, you know, really feel in the building a real happiness, not because it was me, but the idea of having, you know, a woman do this job. It was, you know, there was not of resistance. It was really, people really were happy.
How many people are on the editorial board today, and are there women today?
Oh, there's tons. There may be more women than men. I haven't counted lately. There are, there's about 18, 16 people on the board, and the deputy editor, Carla Robbins, is, of course, a woman, and Eleanor Randolph is, takes state and local, does state and local. Teresa Tritch does, all the economic and all the business finance stuff. I mean, there's Carol Giacoma does foreign policy. I mean, there are women doing very serious lifts all over the place.
Right. So it's changed a lot since Gay Talese wrote The Power and the Glory.
I would say.
On the other hand, there's a lot of talk, and of course, we touched on this a little earlier these days, about young women opting out and choosing to stay home with their kids and rather than pursue a career or put it on hold. Is that a retreat, or is this an indication, the evidence, that the modern role of Wonder Woman must be compromised a bit? What do you think?
I think it's perfectly natural. I mean, as I said before, this is not something that a lot of people may think this would be a nice thing to do, but it's not a choice that a whole lot of women are going to have. And I have noticed that the women who do talk about how they want to, be home and take care of their kids are not talking about how they want to do this for the next 40 years. They want a time out when their kids are younger so they can give them attention. And I'm sure there are tons of guys out there, if they had the opportunity, who would also be thrilled to stop working for a while and, think about other things. And
smell the roses.
Yeah, well, I mean, smell the roses, or just, have a different life for a while.
Right.
I mean, most people
work until
even
they die.
Who like their jobs don't adore their jobs to the point that they can't conceive that it wouldn't be nice to take a break now and then.
And of course, when you love your job, who else do you love? That's that's another problem. People get married to what they do, and their home life suffers also.
Well, there's five different. For every marriage, there's a different story. I mean, for one woman who has children that are just by nature sort of easy, has an entire different experience from one who might have a kid who's hyperactive or,
right,
has some other problem, or just a kid who's, difficult, who's tough, or, that there are husbands who turn out to have careers that make it very easy for them to go back and forth, and, wives the same way. It's just, there's 10 million different. But the real secret, I think, for women who of, success in balancing family and work is to have a husband who's really up for the idea of doing half the work himself.
Right, understanding something and understanding the role and dynamics of a marriage. I've always said, and I've been married over 40 years, is that a marriage is compromise. Getting back to Wonder Woman for a second, I remember my sister, who loved those comics, used to say that she had X-ray vision. So that was, and so even then, back 50 plus years ago, my sister was on the cutting edge. Karen Hale, who lives in London at the present time, Millicent McIntosh told Barnard women at one time they could have it all. Today, with so many women back in the workforce, do they have too much on their plate? Getting back to what they can do, can they be successful with all they do?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of talk lately about, that survey that said that women aren't happy as they used to be. And I often remember that, Ellen Goodman wrote a column years ago, I think back in the 80s, saying, "I find it interesting that all of my female friends are happy and all my men friends aren't very happy." And the reason is that all my male friends thought they'd be president of the United States, and they wound up, teaching college. And all my female friends thought they'd be a part-time receptionist, and they wound up, teaching college. So
Right. They're
thrilled, and their husbands aren't. So there is that sense that, when you grow up with great expectations for your future, you're more likely to be disappointed. And there's some of that. And I think also women aren't unhappy in the sense of being miserable and depressed. They're just very stressed.
Yeah.
They have a full plate.
I've always felt that one of the biggest problems in America, especially with the talk of mental illness being one out of six people, I don't know whether that's promoted by the American Psychiatric Society or not, but the point is that stress kills, and I think we are now that we need two earners or even three to balance a household budget. I think the pressure people on is really extraordinary in a society that what was one of my economic books in college, People of Plenty. You know, I don't know whether there's people of plenty anymore. Meanwhile, I want to remind our audience you're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming at WVOX.com worldwide. And my guest is New York Times journalist and author Gail Collins. I would like to know, and I think this is a critical thing that I know you're obviously aware of, most women are aware of. One of the great changes in the advancement of women has been sports. Being on teams, obviously, especially Title IX. With that in mind, has Title IX affected men in a bad way? Is there any animosity on college campuses because of it? What's your view on that?
And there obviously was at first. There was a famous story about the when they first passed it that Pat Schroeder went back to her district and was touring a high school in
Colorado.
The basketball.
Yeah.
The boys' basketball coach there with his team, and he said, "Boys, show the congresswoman what you think of Title IX," and they all turned around and mooned her. So they didn't think much of it. But everybody thought it would like mean no football or something like right. that. And I think most people have adjusted to it, and for most colleges now, it's so much the normal way of the world that people don't think about it. But there's always been a resentment, I think, on the part of the more marginal guys, sports, the ones that right. don't get, you know, the
skeet shooting.
Yeah, or I think in some town, wrestling was a big one that felt that, you know, it was having trouble because of Title IX. But I mean, we'll live with that. It's been so huge for
and
women.
And actually, women wrestle. I have a long background in amateur freestyle and NCAA and scholastic wrestling. So I'm sort of aware of that on a personal base. But I agree with you. I think the trade-off was much more important that women playing sports started to understand the hurly-burly of win-lose, lose-win-lose. Being part of a team, pulling together, you know, and I've always felt it was, you know, critically important. And, I've always felt that maybe that's going to be one of the most important changes in how women look at each other and how they look at themselves. You know, last year you covered one of the greatest political campaigns in history between Hillary Clinton and President Barack Obama. I don't think in the whole history, and I'm a pretty good student of the presidency, never before were two candidates so well-funded, so different, so capable, and they went right to the end. You know, money is the mother's milk of politics, and they both had it. What were your impressions as a woman, first of all, And of course, when Hillary lost the chance to run for president, what was that a defeat for women in general? You think, Gail?
No, it was. I mean, there were women, women who came of age in the movement who had always sort of thought of that as the Holy Grail, that would be when you would know that they'd won, if when you had a woman in the White House, and they were just brokenhearted when it didn't happen, and very angry, some of them, for a while at Barack Obama, but it did not last, and I think everybody's finally come around to that, and I think that they've come to see that it was just huge for women. It was a huge triumph. The fact that people got so used to the idea that there could be a woman in the White House, or a woman could be commander-in-chief so fast, was just extraordinary. I mean, she didn't lose because she was a woman.
No.
She lost because she failed to organize in the early caucus states,
right.
which is not normally one of your great sexist issues. But
right.
she, by the end, had become a fantastic candidate. I think other women who run for president in the future will look upon her race and will have learned so much from it. And she changed the way people think about women in politics. She just did an extraordinary amount.
Well, actually, when you look back from 1960, Kennedy-Humphrey, which was, held in four or five states, you know, West Virginia, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, a couple of states. I think there were six primaries in 1960 for the fact that Hillary Clinton held her own and came on strong in virtually a 50-state contest. You know, there's a couple of state conventions, you know, here and there, but mostly primaries, some caucuses, which I think are, you know, really basic way for a state to save money, basically.
Yeah.
It was a remarkable race. How do you, and I've had the pleasure of meeting Hillary Clinton when she was campaigning for senator in New York. I did a little work with her, et cetera. How do you view her? I'm assuming you've met her a number of times. How do you see her as an individual?
The thing that amazes me about her is that she can make a mistake and then figure out what she did wrong and then fix it, which is really, really, really hard for people. And some of the ones that she's made have been very spectacular, but they would have left other people just sort of laying in their bed, you know, under the covers for the rest of their lives. And she's always been able to figure out what was wrong and fix it. And that's an extraordinary ability to have. And I mean, that is her great quality, I think, that really puts her above many mere mortals when it comes to most things.
She does not dwell in depression. Not this.
No, and she doesn't... she doesn't get thrown by things. I mean, she seems to be able to, no matter what the crisis, just kind of pick herself up and move on.
You know, the antithesis, it seems, in politics today, and I bring this up as almost an adjunct I didn't plan on, is Sarah Palin, because her book is out. How do you view her, the phenomena about her, and this idea that she is maybe the vanguard of new republicanism? What do you think?
Well, she certainly is the new queen of the right, and I wrote during the campaign, I think, that she's in many ways is an heir to the women's movement, in the sense that I think she's been defined by her sense of class, her sense of having been looked down upon because she was sort of from this redneck town, stuff like that. But as a woman, I can't see any indication that she's ever felt constrained by her gender.
No.
So, I mean, there's that.
Basketball star and newscaster.
You know, she's not one given to talking about the glories of feminism, but she has frequently said that Title IX made a huge difference in her life because she got to play basketball.
Well, I always ask my conservative friends, what do they wish to roll back? What could they do? What are their solutions? I very rarely, I hear a long pregnant pause, it seems, when I say, you know, what do you want to get rid of in America? You want to get rid of birth control? Do you want to get rid of Title IX? You want to get rid of equality for women, Social Security, Medicare? What do you want to roll back? I think there's a kind of sense of frustration that these things have been achieved not under their watch or in spite of their watch. You know, and I've always wondered what their agenda is. What is the real conservative agenda? Is it a values agenda? Because in the red states, there's no real evidence that the values are higher than in the blue states. In fact, there's evidence that they're a lot lower.
Well, there is. I mean, there are different kinds of agendas. I think right now we're seeing sort of a resurgence of the fiscal conservative as opposed to the social conservative. And that's a whole different kind of animal. I'm not quite sure where it's going to go in the next election.
You know, young women are obviously caught between the two worlds of career and family, and recently many of them have been bridging both needs. In that vein, we have only a minute or so left, what would you like younger women to take away from your book?
I'd like them, I mean, women or older tell me that they just love looking back in all the stories and actually remembering what it used to be like back then. I don't want younger women to think this is a way to tell them how much we suffered and they, you know, we walked 50 miles in the snow to get the equal rights.
Like Abe Lincoln.
Yeah, but it's not that. But this is their platform. All these things change to create a platform for them to do the next thing. And I'd like them to think about it in those terms, that this was history unwinding for them forever.
Well, it's certainly a lesson to be learned. I think you've done a marvelous job at it. I think young women have to start learning where they have come from in the same way that young black men should learn a little bit more about Jackie Robinson. I think it's important. This period of time is one of great change. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I want to thank my guest, Gail Collins, who's written extensively about the history of women. I recommend her latest book, When Everything Changed, which is about the amazing journey of women since 1960. Gail, where can that be found?
That
anywhere.
Can be found everywhere.
Good. I usually ask my authors. I know yours is all over. Thank you, Gail, for joining us on The Advocates. And
thank you.
Are there any new projects, quick new projects in the offing?
All right, now I'm writing a biography of President William Henry Harrison. I know that wasn't what you were expecting, but it's true.
All right, very good. Tippecanoe and Tyler, too.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Meanwhile, if you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them at my website, advocates-wvox.com, where the information on my guest, Gail Collins, will be posted. Next week, I'll be speaking to another very politically involved woman, Ann Cook, who has written quite a bit about politics in America. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you out there, and I hope you have a great meal and a great football Thursday. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Advocates on 1460 WVOX. The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon for The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX.
What's important to you on Thanksgiving?
Going to my grandmother's house.
Just getting together.
Being with my family.
Happy holidays from your radio family. We are AM 1460.